KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. With Avatar: The Way of Water cleaning up in theaters, it's clear that James Cameron knows how to make big movies for the big screen. Still, he's not against doing something for a streamer, but he sees a shakeout coming.
It seems to me now that the average viewer has to have 8 or 10 different subscriptions to see everything. So it seems unsustainable on its face, like a big Ponzi scheme to me. I think there's going to have to be some consolidation.
In the first installment of our two-part conversation, Cameron talks about ending up in what he calls an arranged marriage with Disney after making the original Avatar for Fox in 2009. And he has some words for the Avatar haters out there. But first we banter. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
I will note that you are coming to us from Las Vegas, where you are going to the Consumer Electronics Show, where people will be talking about all things intellectual property, I guess, and new new toys.
Las Vegas.
Beautiful.
I'm doing a panel on artificial intelligence and how it will potentially change the game for actors.
Do you have a short summary of how it will potentially change the game for actors?
Well, it could potentially allow people to live forever. A good example, James Earl Jones sold his voice rights to a Ukrainian cloning company that will allow him to be Darth Vader for the foreseeable future, even though he is now 91 years old and retired.
Yes, we've actually touched on this in the past on stories when Paul Walker died and Fast and Furious, and they created a sort of a digital double. Let us move on to the 2022 box office, which we can now see clearly pictured. I mean, it's not a frozen image. It's still going. We have Avatar: The Way of Water from our guest today, about to eclipse Top Gun: Maverick as the number one movie of 2022 internationally. But what we saw was that those two movies that I just mentioned, Top Gun: Maverick and Avatar: The Way of Water, just were the main bright spots that gave hope to people in the industry that movies are not dead and that with the right incentive, audiences will turn out in droves. And that is the upside. The downside, of course, is that box office was off by about 35%, correlating with about 35% fewer movies in the theater. And the question going forward is if the number of movies is ramped up, as it will start to really ramp up following, of course, the pandemic in 2023, will audiences sort of remember that they liked going to the movies, that it's fun to go to the movies, that it's a relatively inexpensive night out in today's world? And will they then start going to more movies? Because it has been this kind of feast or famine year.
Absolutely. And you hit the nail on the head in terms of the releases needing to go up to make the box office go up. Because it's not a coincidence that the percentage decline is about the same as the percentage decline in releases from 2019. That's the scary thing here, because we've seen certain genres of movies that were fairly reliable sources of grosses in theaters just not being that anymore, particularly the family film. Minions was really the only animated film to break out this past year, and there were several. The numbers for the Puss in Boots sequel over the holidays were not great. And that was a really good movie that got good reviews. So have audiences been trained now to accept those animated movies at home or to think that they're about to come into their Disney Plus or other service when they see them advertised for theaters? The other one is the adult drama. I mean, we saw over the holidays, the awards movies, one after another, just flopped in theaters. We got a Steven Spielberg movie, The Fabelmans, that's only at $12 million, which is pretty shocking for a Spielberg movie. And that has been a trend throughout the year. Other than Elvis and Everything Everywhere All at Once, there hasn't been an adult movie that has really broken out like that.
Yeah, a lot of people are concerned. You know, we talked about this before briefly, but, you know, people blame Bob Chapek for having put so many Disney animated movies onto the streamer. And that just created this expectation that if you wait a minute, I think the older audience is also susceptible to that. You know, they think, well, I can wait. And they do wait. And that hurts the box office. Nonetheless, the studios are very motivated. The legacy studios, not Netflix, but the legacy studios that have, you know, these these all kinds of business, they are very motivated and I think have really realized that this rush to streaming, which to be fair to them, have been insisted on by Wall Street, is very toxic for the business, that they do better when movies have some kind of a window in theaters that's exclusive. And then you generate an event that commands more attention, even when it comes to the streamer. But also if you're doing merchandise and toys or whatever, I think they've decided we went too far too fast. But they are not speaking with one voice at this point as to a window. I mean, in an ideal world, you'd say, well, this is the deal, audience. You have to wait what was more recently 72 days. That became closer now to 45 days. But some studios have gone shorter than that or to nothing. It's all over the map. And I think that without colluding, which is illegal, the studios need to maybe achieve some sort of consensus so the consumer knows what to expect.
Well, but that's interesting because these companies have different agendas. I mean, if you look at a company like Warner Brothers Discovery, they are pivoting into theatrical exclusives because they want that revenue up front. And they believe that they can get that revenue from the theatrical release and then the waterfall will flow to HBO Max and further. But then you look at a company like Comcast, which owns Universal Pictures, they're leaning more into the windowing of premium video on demand, where they put the movies in theaters, but then very quickly offer it at home for a significant upcharge for the rental. And then they go to their streaming service, Peacock, and then all the others. So they're trying to get as most money wringed out of these in a different way. And Disney is sort of all over the map, where they're putting some movies, if they're hits like Black Panther, Wakanda Forever, that got a pretty significant theatrical window from November through February. And then a movie that doesn't hit, like Strange World, that was almost immediately dropped on Disney Plus. So you're getting mixed messages from these companies. And I'm not sure that's the best strategy, but it's based on where these companies believe that they are best inclined to benefit long term.
But I think this is still kind of fluid. Like, I'm going to guess strongly that if you ask Donna Langley, who runs the Universal Film Studio, this PVOD thing of moving movies onto premium on demand quickly is not what she would favor necessarily, but her boss, Jeff Shell, who we know is very gung-ho on the window shortening, is in charge. Let me note that at Disney, for example, Chapek, as I said, he generated a certain amount of ill will, to put it mildly, with his decisions. Bob Iger is now in the chair, and he's going to look at this differently. And I did check in on this for a story I did at the end of 2022, and I was told nothing to say at this time. But you have to think that Bob Iger, who comes from a different mindset completely than Bob Chapek, might see this issue of windowing differently, especially when it comes to animation.
Yeah, and I think that there's been a lot of blame placed on Chapek for telling the audience, the family audience in particular, that the best stuff is going to go to streaming. And the Pixar movies, you love them in theaters. Now you can get them in the comfort of your own home. And, you know, I'm not saying Lightyear would have been a hit otherwise, but I think when people saw that, they said, oh, well, that's just going to be on Disney Plus very quickly. And they've got to figure out how to address that. I mean, if that market goes away in theaters, these movies cost $200 million to make a Pixar or a Disney Animation big tentpole movie. And if you're just going to start dropping those on Disney Plus, the economics there don't really add up, I don't think.
Yeah, I think for a lot of the legacy studios, the idea of dropping $200 million on a movie for streaming, you know, as Zaslav has already said, forget it at Warner Brothers Discovery. One of the last things I'll mention in this twist is that Brian Robbins at Paramount, who was supposedly brought in to be the new era of we're pivoting to streaming, we're all in on streaming, he seems to me, as far as I can tell, to be the first guy to pull a movie that was made for streaming out of streaming and put it in theaters. And that was Smile, which he saw and decided to test and said, let's put it in theaters. And it was a hit. So the worms have turned in terms of streaming is the world. And we'll see how we do with that in 2023. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, a founding partner of Puck News. Don't bet against Jim Cameron. That's become a cliche for a reason. Cameron's filmography includes such hits as Terminator 1 and 2 and Aliens, but nothing silenced the doubters like Titanic.
I'm the king of the world!
That film conquered the world after many delays and a budget that blew up repeatedly. Cameron faced skepticism once again with Avatar. Fox almost passed on the 2009 film, and the project was all but set up at Disney when top execs at Fox decided that letting Cameron go might be a bad idea. The film went on to become the number one box office hit of all time. And once again, there were doubters when Cameron announced that he was making 4 Avatar sequels, the first coming more than 10 years after the original. But with The Way of Water passing $1.5 billion in box office so far, Cameron has once again shown why betting against him is just a terrible idea. And in the interim, Disney bought Fox, so the Avatar franchise ended up there anyway. As you will hear, Cameron says it was hard to cut a trailer that sold the first Avatar sequel, but didn't give away too much. In the adrenaline-packed teaser, Jake Sully, played by Sam Worthington, and his Na'vi family are forced by evil human pursuers to seek shelter with an oceanic clan.
Why do you come to us?
The humans are returning.
They're hunting us.
You do not know the sea.
We will learn your ways.
If you want to live here, you have to ride. Yeah!
Must protect the people.
Let's get it done.
Cameron wound up missing the Los Angeles premiere of this long gestating movie because of COVID. He still talked to us over Zoom the next day, but as you'll hear, he was contending with some hoarseness. Congratulations. I saw the film last night. Wow.
Okay, good. Well, you got to go. I didn't get to go, but
I know. I didn't go to the premiere. I went in my neighborhood.
I heard it went well.
Yeah, it did. It was draining. It was.
I hope you mean that in a good way.
I mean it in a good way. I mean it in a good way. I'm trying to figure out, you did Avatar at Fox. The business has been through multiple changes. This has been on the long road. You started out, I guess, was Jim Giannopoulos the executive in charge? And then it goes.
Yeah, Jim greenlit it. Emma Watts, he was the creative executive. We started production under Fox in September of 2017, and then the acquisition played out, I think, Q1 the following year. Is that right?
It sounds rightish. I don't know. All blurs. I mean,
But we knew it was coming, right?
That's what Disney and buying Fox, obviously. Yeah.
We sort of were led to believe that the Avatar overall IP was one of the jewels in the crown of what Disney was acquiring. So we expected them to be leaning forward and wanting to see what we were all about. We had gotten to know the Imagineering folks and the top brass at Disney, Bob Iger included, as a part of creating the
theme
Pandora,
park attraction.
The world of Avatar, the world of Avatar at Animal Kingdom. And that was a creative and technical relationship that had gone on already for probably 3 years by that point. So we weren't exactly strangers. And, you know, the irony is most people don't realize that Disney had actually spent more on Avatar IP than Fox had at that point, because the land cost more than the movie.
That was expensive, but go on.
Yeah. And I'm not going to say exactly what. If Bob Iger wants to tell you how much they spent there, it's up to him.
I'm not going to hold my breath.
Yeah. But, they were quite happy with how all that came out.
Yeah.
And we saw a big uptick in business at Animal Kingdom as a result. So it worked out strategically the way they wanted. And they were excited by the potential of the new films, especially as it was planned out to be a series of films, a saga over time played out in 4 movies. We were already 4 movies by the time of the acquisition. So they knew kind of exactly what they were buying on paper, but they didn't really know us as a production company. And they didn't really have the really granular ins and outs of how an Avatar movie gets made. I mean, they have plenty of experience on big CG and VFX movies, so it wasn't a big leap to talk them through our particular mode of production, which they figured out pretty quickly. And our attitude was absolute, total, radical transparency. You know, come down, hang out, send your people, get in the weeds. We'll talk you through it. If we have problems, we'll work it out as a team. And it's been that way. It's actually been pretty great. For an arranged marriage, I would say going about as well as you could conceivably ask for.
You did have a moment where left the building, Bob Iger. And I have to imagine that was not your happiest day.
You know, we already had a pretty good working relationship with Alan Bergman.
the head of the film studio. Yeah.
Yeah. And we didn't deal with Bob day to day anyway on the film stuff. So it didn't affect us that much. But of course, we were always curious about what the new emphasis would be and, you know, whether we'd get caught in the vortex of Disney Plus and talking about shortening windows and all that sort of thing. But we never got that far in that conversation before, you know, Bob came back. So we're all good. I just talked to him. I just literally talked to him 15 minutes ago.
And, sure it was old buddies, right?
I don't want to overplay it, but we always sort of got along eye to eye. So, you know, we're definitely pretty happy with the way things are working out right now. No disrespect for Mr. Chapek, but I never really got to know him.
I'm sure there was some apprehension, as you said, because he was at that time responding to Wall Street, but all in on the streamer. I'm sure that's a total non-starter, obviously, for a movie like In the Way of Water. You know, that's not on. And a shortened window, same, right? So you never had that conversation, but...
No, it never seemed to be a zero-sum game with Disney. I mean, they seem to be all in on trying to rebuild the theatrical business and all in on the service, you know? And with their scale and their expertise, why not do both?
Yeah, I would think maybe you'd have some question about the marketing spend or stuff like that, but it never came to be.
No, they're you can feel the force of the big global machine behind this.
It's kind of breathtaking, isn't it, when it gets going. It's a big global machine.
It's you know, we always had a great relationship with Fox Distribution, especially on the international side. Really on both sides, but I always thought international did an exemplary job. And I don't see any difference with the Disney team. They seem to be all over it. You know, interestingly, we struggled a bit to find a trailer that didn't undersell the film and didn't give away too much.
Right.
And we went back and forth, and it was very collaborative as we homed in on what we all felt was the final answer, which was the series of trailers that we dropped, I think, were really a consummate campaign. They were intriguing but enigmatic, and they spoke to something kind of subliminal as opposed to overt, which I thought was really pretty good. You know, that was my company meshing gears with Disney perfectly, I thought. Now, I had my eye focused on getting the film done more than the...
Which than you did the, like 2 weeks ago as we're speaking, right? Like 2 weeks ago?
Well, it was down to the wire for us. It always is. The work seems to fill the tummy.
Coming up after the break, James Cameron shares what tempts him to consider making something for a streamer. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on Screen is available now, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Even before Avatar: The Way of Water hit theaters, James Cameron said very publicly that it had to be a top-grossing film to make a profit. But Cameron had reason to be confident. He previously had the highest-grossing film of all time with Titanic, and he still holds that title for Avatar, which opened back in 2009 and was re-released last fall. The Way of Water picks up a few years after the first film left off. Sam Worthington's character, Jake Sully, has become chief of his Na'vi clan and has started a family with Neytiri, played by Zoe Saldana. Their community is thriving until Pandora once again faces invading humans. Early in the film, Jake sits down with his adopted teenage daughter, Kiri, played by Sigourney Weaver. She shares that she's felt a strong connection to Ewa, the life-giving deity of Pandora.
So what is it?
I feel her, Dad.
Feel who?
Ewa. I hear her breathing. I hear her heartbeat. She's so close.
In a year that's seen many movies fall short at the box office, the Avatar sequel, like Top Gun Maverick, has offered proof that audiences will flock to theaters in the streaming era. We will note that, once again, Cameron talked to us when he was dealing with COVID, so he wants to clarify that's why he sounds a little hoarse. I just worked on a story where I talked to a lot of the top studio execs around town, just canvassed them. They were upset with Bob Chapek for putting family movies on the streamer, and even a Marvel movie at one point. I just wonder how you see streaming. I mean, you're not making these movies for a streamer, but how do you see the whole drama? I feel like the studios now are sort of more together in trying to recognizing the value of theatrical release. I don't know if that's been on your radar at all.
Well, look, I mean, I think everybody got caught up in it when the pandemic hurt. I mean, it didn't just hurt it. It killed it. We're like resurrecting out of the grave, you know, now. It killed it dead for about almost a year. And I think everybody had a great story for Wall Street about how they were going to create all this talent. And from what I saw from afar, because I wasn't directly in the game, and there's 50 people in the industry that you could ask that know more about it than I do. But it just seemed like everybody started throwing stupid money at it, generate content, and to try to create a new flow or a constantly refreshing flow. And it seems to me now that the average, you know, viewer has to have 8 or 10 different subscriptions to see everything. So it seems unsustainable on its face, like a big Ponzi scheme to me. And I think there's going to have to be some consolidation. But that said, I'd love to be in on it. I think streaming is an opportunity to do long form. I've always written more than I can conceivably pack into the box of a conventional movie. And I don't like all that interesting character development and interesting scenes getting chopped out either at the scripting stage or in the post stage. You know, we probably took 30, 40 minutes out of Avatar: The Way of Water. We probably took more than that out of Titanic, which was even longer. So in my fantasy life, I'd like to parallel process and do some stuff for streaming where I can write the shit out of it, you know?
Yeah. You certainly have normally at least a lot of energy, maybe not today, but normally.
No, not today. But you know, I certainly have no dearth of ideas. And I like working with other filmmakers, like I did with Robert Rodriguez on Battle Angel Alita, which I thought came out beautifully. It didn't quite make enough money to make everybody grinning from ear to ear, but we may revisit that IP. We hope to anyway.
Now, you mentioned the pandemic flattening the business, and I talked to John Landau in the midst of it, and he was telling me about the protocols. Obviously, New Zealand was very, very careful. And I don't know how you worked, because he was like locked in a hotel room with, it was almost like a prison. And he gets out for like a few minutes a day to go for a little walk.
We both went through what they call MIQ, or managed isolation and quarantine. And it's a 14-day managed quarantine where you're in a hotel room for 14 days. But once you're in the country, you live freely. I mean, it was completely open society, no masks, no restrictions. Until there was an outbreak, and then everything locked down again, and then they got it under control again. So, you know, we went through ups and downs. But in the good times, at least, life was completely normal in New Zealand, except for the fact that you couldn't go outside the country. We lost probably 5 months of downtime, hard downtime, right when everybody locked down in March of 20. And then we got the project back going again by shooting in New Zealand.
Yeah, I read that you said somewhere that you were scared there might not be theaters when we finished the project.
Well, I think that's legitimate. It was certainly a legitimate concern at that point. And even as we speak today, I don't even know where it is these days, but you could say somewhere between 75 and 80% of pre-pandemic levels. And it fluctuates based on surges in different areas and different countries. So with the scale of budget that we have to knock 20 or 25%, right off the top of your potential box office could be our margin, you know, could be the difference between break even and not. And so, you know, the whole thing's still up in the air.
I read somewhere that you said that this is the worst business case in modern movie history.
No, let's put that in perspective. I jokingly said it was the worst business case in history for a movie to have to be in, let's round off, call it the top 10 of all time to break even. And that was before the pandemic.
Okay, great.
Now, on the other hand, you know, if you have to be extraordinary, you figure out a way to be extraordinary.
You seem to do that.
My team certainly pulled together to do that. And I think the results are on the screen. So we just have to see how it plays out. I think as of today, I feel like we got a fighting shot.
Watching it, I thought this is a hit and a big one, but we'll see. As we were speaking, it's just going to be opening. So,
well, look, I mean, the history of Titanic and the history of Avatar were very similar in that they both relied on repeat viewing. It's not going to be about a big weekend, no matter how big the weekend is. It's right. Not going to be about that. Even a $200 million weekend with a normal decay curve doesn't get us where we need to be. People have to want to see it again. And we knew that every second for the last 5 years that we were making this thing. You know, you pack the frame with interest. You pack every scene with interest, with layers, not only the overt thing which is happening narratively, but a sense of physical presence in the landscape and a lot of fractal detail in what you're seeing.
Yes, it's a very rich visual all the way through, to put it mildly.
Yeah, and also creating the emotional experience so that you come out of the theater not quite able to quantify what you've just been through, which it's a difficult target to hit. I think we hit it, but we'll have to see how well we hit it.
I mean, do you have nerves about things like that? You've got a second one basically kind of finished or in the can?
It's in the can. We haven't done much in the way of post. I think 8 or 10 minutes are in over at Weta to get a head start on it. But, you know, we still have to go through the whole virtual camera process and finish. But all the work with actors is done. All the capture work and all the live action photography is done.
I read somewhere that you said you learned not to be defensive about budgets, which I guess is a good thing because your movies are never like $20 million movies. But if it doesn't perform to break even, do you feel like, well, it doesn't matter because, not to be cavalier, you know, there's a theme park that can be refreshed. There's a million other ways and, you know, there will be windows, all of those things.
I think, you know, we have to be very analytical about the results and we have to project out whether there's an increasing curve of movie attendance over the next 2 years as well that we can anticipate. And a lot of metrics are going to go into the post-game analytics on this. But that's a conversation for February, not for right now.
Right. I read that, though, that the second one does not end on a cliffhanger. Is that sort of a consideration of, in case something that I don't think happens will happen?
Movie 3 buttons off probably with greater finality than Movie 2 does. Movie 2 leaves some unanswered, you know, open enigmas. And then a new problem arises in the beginning of movie 4, and then that must be... So really, movie 2 and 3 are kind of grouped as one meta-narrative, and then 4 and 5 are grouped as a second meta-narrative, and then there's a meta-meta-narrative that runs across the whole thing from beginning to end. That's how I break it down in my
multi-dimensional mind. Chess you're playing there.
4D chess.
You don't have the performances for the fourth and fifth in the can, though.
Only the first act of movie 4. And that has to do with our kids aging out of their characters.
Oh, right. You have to think about that.
So we were future-proofing ourselves there.
Interesting. Now, I actually read a quote that you said. I thought it was funny. You said that if you loved the first film, you're going to love these movies. If you hated it, you're probably going to hate these. If you loved it at the time and you said later you hated it, you're probably going to love these. You think people do that?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of different ways to parse this. There's this kind of idea now that it's unhip to have loved Avatar. Mm. And my experience is that, you know, people come in this kind of retroactive denial state, and then they watch a new movie and then they just like, oh yeah, you know. And then there's this revisionist thing. Well, I never really liked it. Like, well, you know, the thing is, we did pretty well for so many people not liking it very much.
James Cameron co-wrote, produced, and directed Avatar: The Way of Water. The film is in theaters everywhere now. Thank you so much, Jim.
Hey, well, it was good talking to you again, Kim, and I'm sure we'll talk again.
I certainly am counting on it.
Okay.
And that's The Business. Joshua Farnham produced and edited today's program with help this week from Katie Gilchrist, Matt Schwartz, and Paul Smith, who mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.